tonight. It seemed dramatic, but is anything really different about North Korea's nuclear program after Kim Jong-un's announcement and President Trump's positive response? We'll look at what the dictator did not say. The nationwide alert for tainted lettuce, what you need to know to stay safe. A jailhouse interview with a Florida school shooting suspect.
I want to be put away, or I can't hurt anyone.
What he says about yesterday's classroom attack. Collecting junk from the ocean and turning it into fuel. We'll go fishing for energy. And remembering Barbara Bush. Four former presidents among those paying their respects to the beloved former First Lady.
This is NBC Nightly News with Jose Diaz-Balart.
Good evening. Tonight, the country that many believe is the greatest threat to U.S. national security, North Korea, is apparently stepping back from the brink of nuclear confrontation. A dramatic announcement by the country's dictator, a suspension of missile and nuclear tests, and the closure of a key nuclear facility. President Trump hailing the move as, quote, progress being made for all. This happens just days before Kim Jong-un and the South Korean president are set to meet here in the DMZ, and just weeks or months before a proposed summit with President Trump. Lucy Kafanoff is in South Korea asking the question, how real is all of this?
The news came with a fanfare North Korea saves for the most important moments. A suspension of nuclear and missile tests and the closing of a nuclear test site. 14 ballistic missile tests since President Trump took office, each one inching the world closer to war. Now, Kim Jong-un says those provocations are a thing of the past, with a major caveat. The announcement promising the suspension will continue as long as there's no nuclear threat and provocation against the North. And no mention that North Korea has any intention of giving up its nuclear weapons, which experts say now number up to 20. Even so, the announcement was welcomed around the world. President Trump tweeting, the European Union and Britain saying it's a positive step, and praise from South Korea, whose president will have his own summit with Kim next week. Moon Jae-in floating the possibility of a peace treaty with the North, a dramatic shift for two countries officially still at war.
In the coming days, the spotlight will be turned right here, one of the most heavily fortified and dangerous borders in the world.
Preparations already underway at Peace House in the demilitarized zone where Kim and Moon will meet next Friday.
We'll have to see what the North Koreans are asking for, and we'll have to see whether they're interested in denuclearization.
An end to the war would be a dream come true for Park Chung-soo, who fled North Korea when she was a young girl just after the war.
Do you trust Kim Jong-un to negotiate for peace?
We have to trust him, she says. The generation has changed.
Pyongyang has broken nearly every promise made to the international community, and here there's hope, but also skepticism that this time's any different. It's unclear whether Kim Jong-un would consider giving up his arsenal in exchange for the right concessions, or whether this is just a ploy to buy more time and economic relief. Jose?
Lucy Kafanoff in Seoul, thank you. Yet another alert today from the CDC about tainted romaine lettuce grown in Yuma, Arizona. More than 50 people now sick from E. coli attributed to this lettuce. NBC's Matt Bradley has the latest.
At the Pasadena Farmers Market this morning, lettuce lovers can shop easy, knowing this locally grown romaine is safe.
I had a couple customers ask about the romaine lettuce, whether or not ours was California grown, if it was safe to eat. And yes.
The concern? Romaine grown in Yuma, Arizona, and shipped across the country. The CDC is warning about an E. coli outbreak from lettuce grown there, telling grocery stores, restaurants, and consumers to toss it all out if they can't be sure where it came from. California growers say that's tough for the average shopper.
The vast majority of people in the nation don't know who their growers are, and so that's where the fear comes from.
The outbreak is now afflicting 53 patients in 16 states.
This is very different than regular old food poisoning.
So far, no one has died, but the symptoms are debilitating, with vomiting, diarrhea, and in severe cases, kidney failure.
In the past, only about a third of patients would get severely ill, requiring hospitalization. This strain seems to be hitting people much harder.
In Salinas, California, famous as the salad bowl of America, industry advocates worry the CDC's blanket warning puts all lettuce in the same tainted bowl. just as the harvest shifts to California's summer season.
We're really looking at lettuce in the grocery stores that's coming from California, not from Yuma, Arizona, and is not affected by this outbreak.
A distinction that puts local shoppers at ease.
We know which farmers are here. I feel confident that we're not going to have any issues.
Matt Bradley, NBC News, Pasadena, California.
It was a tense afternoon in a small town in Georgia as the police cracked down on anti-fascist protesters who tried to disrupt a planned rally by neo-Nazis. The protesters were far outnumbered by the police, hundreds of them, who arrested at least 10 people, some for wearing masks. Late this afternoon, several dozen neo-Nazis were allowed into a park to hold their rally. And in Central America's largest country, at least 10 people are dead after clashes between police and protesters. Nicaraguans have taken to the streets to protest a plan that reduces Social Security payments while increasing the taxes that fund them. Government forces have struck back violently. The clashes started on Wednesday and have grown. The army called out yesterday to protect government buildings. Some insights tonight into the mind of a young man accused of bringing a gun to his former school in Florida yesterday and shooting into a classroom. And they come from the suspect himself in a jailhouse interview after he was taken into custody. NBC's Morgan Radford has that story.
Yesterday, while students around the country rallied against gun violence and called for safer schools,
put your hands up.
This scene was unfolding in Ocala, Florida, a school shooting just 4 hours from Parkland Stoneman Douglas High.
Everything is gone.
The alleged shooter, a 19-year-old dropout.
You know, I'm alone in my house and there's nothing to do, so the depression and that rage came back, so I expressed it in violence in public, which I shouldn't have done.
You could tell that he was troubled. I think he was grappling with the gravity of the fact that he knew that he did something wrong.
Sky Boucher sat down with local NBC reporter Matt Lupoli just hours after being arrested and described the moment he went to his old high school ready to shoot.
This adrenaline rush that, you know, I'm about to just do something, and, you know, I spend most of my time in a room alone, so, like, I'm getting this rush, so that's what I was feeling.
He bought the gun online after the Parkland shooting without a background check and says he walked right in.
There's no one to stop me like I thought there would be. And I just got into the bathroom. I took my time putting on my gloves, my tactical vest.
And then he fired a single shot through a door, hitting a 17-year-old boy.
I heard someone screaming like they were hurt, because I never heard that scream before.
Boucher says taking lives wasn't part of his plan. And when he saw the look of fear in a young girl's eyes, he put the gun down.
I could have shot her, but I just couldn't do it.
He says he gave himself up to a teacher who stayed with him until he was taken to jail. Now, he says, solitary confinement is the only thing he sees in his future.
I want to be put away where I can't hurt anyone.
Well, that 17-year-old victim is in stable condition. And as for Boucher, he says he wanted to join the Marines after dropping out of high school, but was rejected on mental health grounds. Now he's facing charges of terrorism, aggravated assault, and having a gun on school property.
Morgan Radford, thank you so very much. In Houston today, Barbara Bush was remembered by her family and friends as they gathered at the funeral for the former First Lady. It was an extraordinary turnout that included four former presidents and the current First Lady. NBC's Kelly O'Donnell is following it all and has our report.
In Houston today, a rare gathering of presidential families. Side by side, decades of American leadership drawn together without friction for one exceptional life.
Barbara Bush was the First Lady of the Greatest Generation.
The wife and mother of presidents, but today it was Barbara Bush herself, celebrated for her values, strengths, and impact.
Barbara, the tough but loving enforcer, was the secret sauce of this extraordinary family.
Her husband of 73 years, George Herbert Walker Bush, was comforted by daughter Dorothy. Family, an enduring reflection.
Strength and dignity are her clothing.
Through tears came laughter.
She called her style a benevolent dictatorship, but honestly, it wasn't always benevolent.
Son, Governor Jeb Bush, said being real inspired true affection.
We learned to strive to be genuine and authentic by the best role model in the world. Her authentic plastic pearls, her not culling her hair. By the way, she was beautiful till the day she died.
Grandsons guided the flower-draped casket. As the motorcade left the church, admiration lined the streets of Houston. On one last journey to a private burial at the presidential library, Barbara Bush, an American matriarch with a legacy all her own.
Today, President Trump was not in attendance, and First Lady Melania Trump was here to represent their family. She called Mrs. Bush a woman of indisputable character and grace. She also brought two guests to the funeral service, two men who had been part of the household staff in the White House residence and had been particularly close to the Bush family. Jose?
Kelly O'Donnell in Houston, thank you. As for President Trump, he spent part of his day attacking a report suggesting that his longtime lawyer and advisor, Michael Cohen, might turn on the president after the FBI raided his office and hotel room and seized records and other documents. We get more from White House correspondent Jeff Bennett.
In a Saturday morning Twitter tirade, President Trump blasts the New York Times after the paper ran a story suggesting the president's longtime personal attorney and fixer, Michael Cohen, might be willing to cooperate with federal investigators. The New York Times and a third-rate reporter are going out of their way to destroy Michael Cohen and his relationship with me in the hope that he will flip. The Times says Cohen's unyielding loyalty might be lagging after years of Trump treating him poorly with gratuitous insults, dismissive statements, and at least twice threats of being fired. The president adds, "Most people will flip if the government lets them out of trouble. I don't see Michael doing that despite the horrible witch hunt and the dishonest media." So what accounts for the president's fury?
If presented with an opportunity to limit prosecution against himself, Michael Cohen just might tell federal prosecutors whatever they want to hear.
The FBI raided Cohen's office and residences earlier this month, looking for evidence of crimes, partly in connection to payments Cohen made to two women, each claiming affairs with Mr. Trump, allegations the president denies. The attorney for one of the women, Stormy Daniels, says he's certain Cohen will turn on Mr. Trump.
Michael Cohen knows where almost all the bodies are buried, and I think he is going to sing like a canary.
Cohen, for his part, has denied any wrongdoing.
And multiple sources close to Mr. Trump and Michael Cohen tell NBC News that if faced with significant criminal charges and the prospect of jail time, Michael Cohen would not remain loyal to President Trump. Jose?
Jeff Bennett, thank you very much. With all the other news this week, you might have missed what happened in Cuba. For the first time in almost half a century, a Castro is not Cuba's head of state. Raul Castro handpicked a new president. That comes as U.S. relations with the Cuban regime have turned worse. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez was there and has our report.
At La Fabrica, a popular art gallery and club in Havana, a key to Cuba's future has hit a wall. The owner, X Alfonso, tells us there's been a dramatic drop in American visitors.
I am canceling.
It started after President Trump rolled back Obama administration reforms here last year, most notably on travel, condemning the Castro regime for its human rights abuses. Now he and nearly 600,000 other Cubans working in the private sector are facing an uncertain future.
You feel that the relationship now under the Trump administration has gone the other way?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah, everything's stopped.
Almost six decades after Fidel Castro's rise to power, Cuba is at a crossroads. On Thursday, Raul Castro stepped down as president, taking his place a largely unknown bureaucrat, Miguel Díaz-Canel, who promises to continue the island's communist revolution.
And what do you think it will mean for the island?
I'm waiting.
Waiting?
I'm waiting.
For what?
Yes. We don't know anything about it.
Seeking to control the pace of change, last year the Cuban government stopped issuing new private business licenses. Internet access is still expensive in a country where the average state salary is $30 a month. We met these bloggers in a park where they use the public Wi-Fi.
Most important change is that we are not going to have a Castro in power again.
It's hard to imagine life after a Castro.
I'm 30 years old. I'm trying to work and live in Cuba, but I don't know what's going to happen.
Like most things in Cuba, unlocking that future won't come quickly. Gabe Gutierrez, NBC News, Havana.
Still ahead tonight, a new kind of harvest from the sea, how the catch of the day may be saving the planet. Also, the stunning new images from outer space as the Hubble telescope marks a milestone. On this Earth Day weekend, we want to take a look at a fascinating new source of power. It comes from the sea, but it has nothing to do with anything that grows in the ocean other than the growing amount of trash that winds up in the water. Here's our chief environmental affairs correspondent, Ann Thompson.
Off the Florida Keys, fishermen are hauling in a different kind of catch, hooking hundreds of damaged lobster traps hidden underwater. Debris from last year's Hurricane Irma.
Right here.
From the bridge of his lobster boat, Jeff Kramer tallies the cost.
I lost about 1,300 traps out of my 3,400 traps.
So you lost more than a third?
Yes.
More than 300,000 traps gone. Losses for creatures above and below. And it's not just lobster traps. 640,000 tons of fishing gear is abandoned each year around the world.
What kind of danger does debris like this pose to the marine life?
Well, one, it smothers healthy habitat. When storms come and high winds, this stuff moves around. And it actually bumps up to coral reef tracks, which are endangered around here.
Now the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation teams with NOAA and local fishermen to catch some of that gear and turn it into energy. At no cost, the ocean trash is taken to a Covanta plant, where the recyclables are separated, and then the rest mixed with these mountains of trash and burned to power 45,000 Miami homes.
How do you compare to more traditional power fuels such as coal, oil, and natural gas?
We're cleaner than coal, we're cleaner than oil, and we're really on a par for sulfur compounds, nitrogen compounds, CO2, and for particulates with natural gas.
A process so successful that it happens in 10 states on both coasts, powering our world by cleaning up theirs. Ann Thompson, NBC News, the Florida Keys.
And up next, we'll take you to a party fit for a queen. The scene in London's Royal Albert Hall this evening as a star-studded birthday party for Queen Elizabeth was held. The Queen turned 92 today, took the stage with her son and heir, Prince Charles. Among those attending, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, whose wedding at Windsor Castle is less than 1 month from now. It's become a kind of unofficial wonder of the world and other worlds. We're talking about the Hubble Space Telescope, which is about to mark 28 years exploring the universe and sending back remarkable images. To celebrate, NASA and the European Space Agency released some stunning new pictures of the Lagoon Nebula, a place where many stars are born and probably other things too. It's located in the constellation Sagittarius, in case you're wondering. And a sad note tonight, Vern Troyer has died. He was best known for playing Mini-Me in the Austin Powers movies. The 2-foot-8 tall actor also had roles in Men in Black and Harry Potter and The Sorcerer's Stone, among others. In a statement, his family suggested that depression may have been an issue for Troyer. Vern Troyer was 49 years old. When we come back, it's no longer just the boys in the band, the new faces and voices of mariachi. Finally tonight, it's a musical tradition that goes back hundreds of years, starting in Mexico and expanding far beyond. And until relatively recently, mariachi was almost always performed by men. But that's changing now in a big way. From Texas, here's NBC's Maya Rodriguez.
It's showtime at Luna Music Bar in San Antonio. On stage tonight, Mariachi Las Alteñas. The musicians are all women, part of a wave of ladies making mariachi their own.
What do you play?
I started playing the violin and the orchestra, fifth grade strings.
Valerie Vargas founded the group.
The idea of having my own all-female group was something that I was definitely interested in.
Texas is leading the way with more and more women playing mariachi.
It was usually always men. I don't remember seeing too many female mariachis when I was younger.
But that is changing. At Brackenridge High School, more than half of John Nieto's mariachi students are girls.
The male only adds so much, but the female voice just makes it that much better.
For juniors Donna Chavez and Paloma Arellano, it's a chance to connect with their heritage.
I feel it's empowering.
I just think it's another way of me getting in touch with
my roots and my culture and a big part of me.
They're joining in part thanks to former music teacher Bel Ortiz.
Ah, I never thought it was going to happen.
Back in the 70s, Bel fought hard to get mariachi instruction into public schools here, credited with helping give girls the chance to play.
They're as good as men, mariachis. I remember I had an incident that one of the young ladies said, my mother says I can't play a man's instrument in mariachi. I can play mariachi, but I can only play violin. I said, honey, if you want to play a guitarrón, here it is.
What's it like to see these women embrace that part of their culture?
Proud. I am so proud of them.
Back at Luna Bar, Mariachi Las Salteñas prepare to wrap up their set and return to their everyday lives as teachers, nurses, and businesswomen.
We call each other superwomen sometimes. We do multiple things. It's not just mariachi. That's what brings us together. So it's pretty special.
Together, changing tradition, thanks to a shared passion for this music. Maya Rodriguez, NBC News, San Antonio, Texas.
That's NBC Nightly News for this Saturday. On tomorrow's Nightly News with Kate Snow, we'll tell you about the surprising place where authorities want to jam cell phones to keep people safe. I'm Jose Diaz-Balart reporting from New York. Thank you for the privilege of your time. Good night.